Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, this panel of the court. Today's date is February 5, 2019. This panel of the court today has six cases on its calendar, five of which will be submitted with oral argument and one of which will be submitted without oral argument solely on the briefs. First case on today's oral argument calendar is number A18-1059, Buck Blacktop Inc. versus Gary Contracting and Trucking Company, LLC. I think counsel know you each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have an opportunity for rebuttal. When you approach the lectern, please state your name for the audio record. You may begin.
Good morning. My name is Joseph Cantor, K-A-N-T-O-R. I'm going to be arguing on behalf of the appellant Gary Contracting and Trucking and Gary Barichka. I'm listed as second on the signature line, but I am recognized in all of the pleadings. The facts have been briefed by both parties, and unless there's any questions about the facts, I'm going to jump right into the legal argument. The legal argument is essentially as follows, that this is a confession of judgment case. It was filed with the district court pursuant to a signed confession of judgment. Judgment was entered, motion was made to vacate the judgment, which was denied. The arguments that were made at the district court level did not apply to the standard that the district court judge actually used. The arguments that were made at the district court level were reasonable time for filing under 6002F in favor of the appellants to have the judgment dismissed. In opposition to that, by the defendants and respondents here, they argued that the judgment was valid, and so therefore there was no reason to vacate the judgment. The district court went on to analyze the motion under what has been called the Findon factors, which apply to default judgments. The judge in the district court used Bank International as well as a Westlaw case to find that those four factors all need to be applied to a motion to vacate for a confession of judgment case.
If the four Findon factors do not apply, what is the governing law?
We believe that it's under the Bank International Luxembourg versus Dakota Companies case that all that needs to be shown is that it's brought within a reasonable amount of time.
Isn't that just a threshold issue that then gets to some substantive consideration or some substantive criteria?
Except I would say a qualified yes. The substantive criteria was also addressed in that decision and said when it's a statute of limitations defense, nothing else needs to be shown. What had happened in Bank International was the motion to vacate was about, or the appeal issue was whether or not it could be conditioned on the filing of a bond. And that was the primary reason that the motion to vacate was not granted. The $400,000 bond was too onerous for the defendants to obtain. And as part of this decision, they said the court in that case said that a rule or a motion to vacate a confession of judgment logically fall under 602F, and the question is whether it was filed within a reasonable amount of time. And then they went on to say, on these facts, it would not have been because it was 3.5 years.
I mean, that was the only issue in that case, but I mean, I think that was a threshold issue, but if one gets be, you know, if a motion is filed within a reasonable time, one has to do more than that, right? That's not the end of the, you don't get vacature automatically just by filing a motion within a reasonable time.
I would agree, Your Honor. And the second concern is the statute of limitations defense. If there's a valid defense for statute of limitations, I believe that, I guess the appropriate way to address this, Your Honor, is the defense and the motion to vacate based on a statute of limitations defense? If it is, then was it filed in a reasonable amount of time? If you look at it the other way around.
Then I assume, I mean, that the court must ask, Is the limitations defense valid?
Yes.
Was the confession of judgment filed in a timely manner or not?
Yes, I would say that that would be a necessary.
I'm not saying that's true. I'm saying that's your argument, I think.
Yes, yes, Your Honor, that is the argument.
So are you really asking us for a result that's based on a holding, a rule of law that's never been expressly stated?
I believe in Bank it was stated, but it was probably considered dicta because that wasn't the issue before the court, even though they expounded on it. But yes, I do believe that this is a ripe issue for publication. I do believe that this is something that hasn't been clearly delineated.
So the holding you advocate would be what exactly?
That if there is a confession of judgment that is filed in the district court, and there's a motion filed within a reasonable amount of time to vacate it based on a statute of limitations defense, that the Findon factors do not apply because, one, the second element, excuse for failing to answer, cannot be met because there's no notice provision in a confession of judgment. If you apply that under every single case, you wouldn't be able to answer that question because there's no notice on these types of confessions of judgment. So Findon cannot apply. It has to be something else. And that something else would be reasonable defense on the merits based on a statute of limitation, brought in a reasonable amount of time, and whether or not the statute of limitations defense would be valid at the district court.
Now, your motion was premised on clauses D and F of the rule, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And this court in Majestic said that clause D is not an appropriate legal basis for an argument about a limitations defense to a confession of judgment, correct?
Correct. That's on the void issue, I believe, is what you're getting at, correct?
Well, that's what clause D says,
yes,
that the
yes.
judgment is void, and that really the more appropriate one is clause F.
That's correct. We would concede that, Your Honor. At the time we wrote the brief, we viewed the judgment as a void judgment, but after arguing at the district court level and further research, we realized it was voidable, not void.
I think your memo cited both D and F.
At the district court level.
Right.
Yes, that's correct. But we didn't raise that here because we realized after.
Didn't raise what?
D.
I see. Got it.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. So we did recognize that, Your Honor.
So do you know what the case law says about whether in a motion to vacate premised on clause F, whether the four Findon factors apply, either always, never, sometimes?
I haven't been able to find anything along those lines except for Bank International, Majestic, and then, of course, the Court of Appeal or the District Court cited the Foss v. House, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, Haushahn decision. We don't have a copy of that, Your Honor. We haven't been able to locate a copy of that just because of the nature of the electronic record systems with the Court of Appeals. So that may be on point, and the district court seemed to think it was on point, but we believe it was erroneous to use it. It was an unpublished decision that we don't have access to.
So an analysis of a statute of limitations requires one to identify when the cause of action has accrued. When did this cause of action accrue?
On May 21st, 2013, when they signed the Confession of Judgment, Your Honor. Confession of Judgments and the cases that have been cited and we're talking about actually discuss this. Confessions of Judgments and Pleas of Confessions have very similar but divergent language. Most Confessions of Judgments that I've seen and that the cases talk about will say, I confess the amount of $50,000 to be paid at $1,000 a month for 50 months at a certain amount of interest. If you miss a payment, there will be a certified letter that's sent out notifying you of default and an intent to accelerate with a 15-day window to cure. If you don't cure, we'll file the confession of judgment. That would be a notice provision that would satisfy the second element of Findon. The confession of judgment in this case is a very basic statement of confession. It's just this amount of money. There's no triggering event. There's nothing in there that says you can pay it off on this schedule. These are the dates that payments are due. It just says you're authorizing a confession of judgment. The day it's signed, it could have been filed. There's no need for a default. So under our analysis, the...
So then your client was in control of whether there would be a sufficient notice provision.
I'm not sure how you... Are you talking about because of the way it was drafted, Your Honor?
Right.
We did not draft it. The defendant's attorney drafted it and was presented to my client as a settlement option. I don't know where that would be reflected.
But your client participated in the decision to...
To sign it.
Right.
Yes, that's correct.
And your client could have insisted upon a notice provision.
He could have required a notice provision if... Again, I was not involved in the negotiations
sure,
on that point.
Sure, not faulting you. I'm just saying, as you know, who bears the responsibility for requiring this triggering event?
I would say that would be a joint responsibility. However, I would point out well-established law in Minnesota that if it's drafted by one party, it's construed against the drafter.
Well, that's if it's that's if it's ambiguous.
That's correct.
There's nothing ambiguous about the confession.
It's just missing
statement here.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
So there's nothing to construe.
There's nothing to construe except for when the cause of action accrued. And my point is, if there is nothing in there that is, signifies a separate triggering event, that confession of judgment could be filed on the day it's signed.
So I just want to make sure I understand what you're asking this court to do as opposed to the district court to do.
Yes.
Okay, so you're clearly asking us to reverse the order and say defendant factors do not apply under Clause F.
Yes, that's correct.
But then in your brief you say, and order briefing, vacate the judgment, order briefing on the issue of whether the garnished funds should be returned. I just want to understand, are you asking us then to decide the statute of limitations question? Are you asking us to remand to the district court to decide the statute of limitations? And what do you mean by whether the garnished funds should be returned?
That's a very good question, Your Honor. I believe that because we're talking about the right or wrong standard to apply, it's a de novo. If you decide that Finden was the correct standard, we still believe it was inappropriately applied, which would be an abuse of discretion. So you can send it back down. Then we have an argument as to it was avoidable judgment. Should it have been garnished at all when we raised this issue prior to the money being taken? So now, if you send it back to the district court and say, you have the power under de novo to say, no, this statute of limitations is valid. This is when it accrued. This is when it could have been filed with. Take action commensurate with this, which would likely be dismissal. However, we still have an open question of what happens with the $15,000 that was already taken. So the request there is that any order that you issue on remand would take that into consideration so that the judge doesn't immediately dismiss it without an opportunity to either argue the issue of the money coming back or saying, no, it was a voidable judgment and it wasn't voided at the time of garnishment, so it's still a valid garnishment. We just don't want it dismissed entirely without making that argument first.
Thank you.
And as it applies to whether if you do decide that Finden was the correct standard, we still believe that it was an abuse of discretion because there's a number of things that were not briefed and not argued, but were included. For example, prejudice to the opposing party. Neither side argued that. And if you look at the brief we filed here, we did point out that they were able to, respondents or defendants at the trial court level, were able to come up with affidavits and documents supporting their case. And the prejudice is that the prejudice that's envisioned under that fourth element is that so much time has elapsed that evidence has gone missing or been destroyed and not available. And we would argue that, for example, in here, that can't be met, even though it hasn't been argued, because they've come up with all the evidence and testimony they need. In terms of the second factor, the reasonable or excuse for failing to quote-unquote answer, the district court judge also abused the discretion there. If you look at what happens with a default, you have summons and complaint that's served, 20 days pass. If you want to have attorney's fees, you get another attorney's fees notice, 20, 30 days. Then you get a default judgment. And the excuse or the failure to act is, why didn't you answer? That doesn't apply here. And so the judge shoehorned in the time period back to 2013 where the confession of judgment was signed. So we believe that's also an abuse of discretion. There has to be a reasonable time period to look at, and that's one of the reasons why we don't believe Finden applies. But even if it does apply, you can't look back 6 years to when the confession of judgment was actually signed. We believe that's an abuse of discretion. The due diligence, we also believe was an abuse of discretion, because there's plenty of case law out there that has said if it's filed within 3 months, 3.5 months, 4 months, that's a diligent litigant. We're not talking about 3.5 years. We're not talking about 6 years. We're not talking about at 9.5 years in response to a motion to renew a new action to renew a judgment. This was filed in November, some type of actual notice in December, motions filed in February. This is not someone who sat on their rights. He was talking to attorneys and working actively to undo this. I have 40 seconds remaining. If there's no questions, I can wait for my reply time.
I have a question about the procedural history. Before the order denying the motion to vacate, the district court had a previous order ruling on, I think, request for an exemption or for a stay. In that first order, didn't the district court basically reject the limitations defense? And then in the later order, said that it's a reasonable defense on the merits? I mean, it seems inconsistent to me.
I don't believe that in the first order it was actually decided in that manner. I believe in the first order it was decided, and I'll look at this when I'm sitting down, but I believe that it was decided more on the basis of we had not brought, or we, the defendants, had not brought the appropriate procedural motions to stay the garnishment. We had not articulated the reason for it. We had not sought a TRO. We had not provided a bond instead of actually getting to the merits of the statute of limitations. And I'll review that order while I'm sitting down. But
okay. Thank you, Mr. Cantor. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is David S. Holman, H-O-L-M-A-N. I'm appearing for the respondent, Buck Blacktop, in this matter. We're here today because of three decisions that were made by the appellants in this case. They hired my client to perform work for which appellants were paid for, and then they kept the money. That gives rise to some pretty harsh consequences under the statutes that apply. Buck Blacktop argued or threatened to commence suit to enforce the rights under those statutes, or offered to have a confession of judgment executed by the defendants, the respondents, or the appellants. That's what they chose to do. They executed a confession of judgment, and in connection with that execution, they requested Buck Blacktop, please don't file that. We would like an opportunity to work off the indebtedness. Seems reasonable to me. There was no deadline in that confession of judgment for which to file it. Buck Blacktop honored that request. The work off never occurred. 3 years later, Buck Blacktop discovered the respondents were selling their business premises. That's what prompted the filing of the confession. 3 months went by without any phone call, any motion, any response from the respondents. It wasn't until a bank garnishment was sent and $15,000 was garnished. That is what got the respondents' attention. They brought their motion to vacate. I believe you're correct, Your Honor. I was a little bit surprised with the trial court in the denial of the exemption cueing in on the fact that we use statute, there's two governing statutes for confessions. We use the statute 548.22 specifically states without action. There was never any action in this case.
What does that mean, without action?
It's a way of avoiding litigation. In the Majestic v. Berry case, the court specifically identifies the purpose of 548.22. It's to bring about an efficient result or conclusion to a dispute. This is exactly the intent of my client instructing me to write a letter to say to the respondents, hey, we're going to sue and we're going to go after attorney's fees. or we can resolve it with a confession of judgment. It's without action.
Yeah, I don't think either party cited 548.24, the next statute, which is captioned submission without action, and that's there's a full paragraph of a statute that I think describes what that means. But I think that without action means that it still means that there is a case pending.
There's a filed judgment, no doubt. No doubt about that, Your Honor. But I believe what is being confused by the appellants is the interplay or the application of 548.23, which governs pleas of confession, and it requires a separate instrument, a distinct instrument authorizing a confession of judgment. If you then jump to the statute of limitations argument, it states confession, the heading of the statute for the one-year time limit specifically refers to instruments got it right here, authorizing a confession. That's not what was that occurred in this case. This was a straight confession of judgment out of 548.22.
So is it your position that the one-year statute of limitations applies to a plea of confession under 0.23 but not to a confession of judgment under 0.22?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And what's your authority for that?
The 5.22, there's no due date. When a judgment is entered, that is the end of the case. There, it's supposed to be a finality end to the case. We know that money's owed and there is a judgment. In the plea of confession, there is normally a time frame, and I think opposing counsel cited this, there's a time frame for payments that are due. A payment is due on a certain due date, and if that payment's missed, we know when the cause of action accrues. And they've kept a short leash on that, a one-year statute of limitations, when we know there's a default in that payment. And
is there any case law that recognizes a distinction between the two types of instruments?
I believe it's recognized.
But what I mean is with respect to the statute of limitations. I mean, to support your point that...
No, there's not. There's not. The Berry, the Majestic v. Berry case does point to the differentiation between both confessions, but in that case, the statute of limitations, I mean, they allowed the plea of confession to be filed in that case 3 years after the default occurred, and they said that was not a void judgment, it was an erroneous judgment, but because it was an erroneous judgment, that doesn't mean that it's void. But I believe we have an argument being made by appellants to essentially write in a due date in the statute 548.22. And the legislature just hasn't done that. They're allowing a party to sign a confession by a statement. And in this case, the parties... A request was made that was honored by my client not to file the confession.
So under your interpretation then, is there no statute of limitations? I mean, so you could wait 20 years?
Obviously, nothing can last forever, Your Honor. It's a very good point. However, a confession, a judgment in and of itself, if it's filed, is good for 10 years. In this case... Maybe we're bordering on the latches argument as to when do you have to assert that right.
So you're not suggesting that there's a direct correlation between a confession of judgment and a judgment as to the longevity of either? You mentioned 10 years is the...
10 years if the judgment's docketed.
Right.
If the confession of judgment in this case, when it was docketed, it's a confession good for 10 years.
And that's the question I have for you. You're suggesting that that the time period to act on a judgment is the same as the time period to act on a confession of judgment.
No, I'm not arguing that, Your Honor. I think it's an open question. I don't think there is a definitive answer. I know there's not a definitive answer as to how long you can actually wait before you go and do the filing. In this case, the waiting occurred because the respondents asked for time to work off the debt. In the Berry case, that attorney waited 3 years, maybe 3.5 years, to file the confession. And the reason, then 3.5 years after that went by, when the motion was brought by the Mr. Berry, because he was having trouble getting credit. He let that judgment sit for 3.5 years, and he realized there's an impediment here. I can't get credit. So then he brought his motion to vacate, some 6 years or 7 years after the transaction that promulgated that motion.
Why? Well, did the district court abuse its discretion by basing its decision on Fendon factors that weren't briefed or supported by the parties?
I think the court found the right standard in the Bank International case that cites the Lyon case from the Supreme Court of 1973. That does not limit the Fendon factors to just default judgment motions.
Were the parties then mistaken in its approach in their approaches to the district court and not zeroing in on the Fendon factors that the court ultimately relied on?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor. If we read the unpublished case that cited the Foss case by the court, this court had those same apprehensions about applying the Fendon factors to a confession of judgment case. I will stand, I'll accept that it is irregular. However, the Supreme Court said what it did in 1973, that we apply Fendon to all judgments. In that respect...
It said that in Fendon?
No, it said that in the Bank International case citing... which Court of Appeals, citing Lyon, 1973 Supreme Court case. It's argued in our brief that the Fendon factors apply to judgments, period, not just default judgments. It does create some abnormalities because there's a difference, and that's where that Foss case hones in on that. And it does, with apprehension, go through the Fendon factors. Your Honor.
If this court were to determine, I'm not saying we will, and I understand you don't take that position, at least in this court. If we were to say the Fendon factors do not apply to Rule 6002F, then what should we do next?
The case should be affirmed on appeal because the trial court made the right decision. It made the correct decision. I do disagree. And I argued in the brief, I take issue with the court, the district court's finding that a statute of limitations applies to 548.22. And the statute, the one-year statute applies to pleas of confession under 548.23.
So you would say even if we adopted the appellant's view of the law as to the statute of limitations, your view is that in this case, there is no supported statute of limitations defense, and therefore...
Correct. Correct. I believe the judgment stands.
What about, I'm wondering, I think in the district court, one or both parties cited an old case, Berg versus Burkholder Lumber, Supreme Court 1925. And that appears to be a case where there was a confession of judgment, and it was vacated. I'm reading now, paraphrasing from the syllabus of the court. Confession of judgment was properly vacated because the action was not commenced within 1 year after the accrual of the cause of action as required by, and then an old statute, differently numbered. And the proceeding resulting in a judgment in favor of one party and against another is an action within the meaning of that statute.
That sounds like the, I can't recall. I remember reading the Byrd case back when the motions were briefed at the trial court level. I believe that's under the plea of confession with a separate plea. It is not a straight statement that's filed authorizing a judgment to be entered.
And I think your opposing counsel traced the statutes differently, that this was the predecessor of the .22 confession of judgment statute. But if that is so, it seems like this is an illustration of how a party in appellant's position may obtain the vacature of a judgment arising from a confession of judgment. Correct?
Correct, Your Honor. I do believe, though, with the statute 548.23, using the exact, I mean, the word instrument does not appear in statute 548.22. An instrument of confession appears in 548.23 and the one-year statute of limitations. You need to have that. What they're trying to do, if I sell you a car, Your Honor, and I'm an enterprising car salesman, what they used to do in the old days is you'd sign a promissory note and then sign a cognizant note authorizing me to get a judgment against you if you don't make your payments. It's a pretty harsh result. They require it to be a separate instrument apart from the contract you sign because they don't want enterprising attorneys to bury the confession language in the fine print. It's a pretty extreme way of getting a judgment, and that's why there's a one-year statute if you don't receive your payment. We know when that cause of action accrues. There is a payment date and it's not made. You have 1 year to file that judgment.
Isn't it under
542.2, there is not that definition.
Under the .22 statute, isn't it typical that there is a written agreement apart from the confession of judgment, which has certain terms and perhaps conditions? You know, if here's, you know, so-and-so agrees to forbear and there's an opportunity to cure within, let's say, 6 months, and if the debtor does not cure, then the creditor may file the confession of judgment. I mean, isn't that typical?
There's leeway in the statute to draft the confession that way. That's correct. There's a due date in that application, though. Okay. I mean,
and that was not done here, right?
It was not done here. This is a one-page, essentially. On our best day in court, we would get a judgment for the $50-some thousand and our attorney's fees on the theft by contractor statute. What the court is going to do is give us a judgment for that amount. The parties negotiated, let's save that expense and let's expeditiously resolve this dispute. We'll waive attorney's fees. You sign the confession. No time frame to make a payment. No deadlines. We had the confession, and we could have filed it. We could have went, if he requested, please don't file it, we'd like an opportunity to work it off, we could have said, ha, too late. We already have a confession you've signed. We're going to go and file it. We didn't do that. We honored their request to give them the opportunity to try to work this off. It only became apparent to us 3 years later when they started selling assets. That's not going to happen. They weren't being earnest in their request to work this off.
So what recourse is there? Let's imagine a hypothetical where there's a confession of judgment for $100,000 and the debtor pays off half of it, so they've discharge $50,000 of their debt, and then the creditor, holder of the confession, files it anyway, gets a judgment for $100,000. I mean, what's the procedural mechanism where the debtor can challenge that judgment to say, wait a minute, that's not the amount of my debt, I only owe $50,000?
Well, that's borderline fraud, and the judgment creditor holding that judgment should be under a duty to play by the rules and file a partial satisfaction.
Yeah, you're right, it's wrong. So what's the procedural mechanism for the party, the judgment debtor, to then seek some relief?
The debtor would have to bring a motion compelling the creditor to file that partial satisfaction.
And
I may not be following you.
A motion under what rule? I mean, it seems like Rule 60 here is the only thing one can turn to in that situation to right that wrong.
There might be a, under the judgment statute, there might be a requirement, and I'm sure there's a requirement in either 548 or 550 of the statutes that requires a judgment creditor to file a satisfaction or a partial satisfaction.
Okay, there's the requirement, but what is, I mean, where is the teeth? I mean, what if the person doesn't do that, then what?
If I were the judgment debtor in that instance, I'd be writing a letter to the judgment creditor and threatening bad faith attorney's fees for failing to file a partial satisfaction.
And if they refuse?
Then you bring the motion.
What motion?
For failing to follow the statute.
But a motion for what relief? Under what legal authority?
Some sort of mandamus, which typically applies to public figures not doing their job. In this instance, it would be an officer of the court not doing their job.
Anything else?
Well, I am very scared.
Somehow our clock has stopped. You've gotten. Yeah.
Am I 5 minutes in, Your Honor?
I don't know, but you've gotten. What's that?
He's over.
Yeah, I think you are. Perhaps you could wrap up.
I'll wrap up, Your Honor, and just that to argue that the Findon factors are irregular to apply in this situation, but the Supreme Court said what it did in the Lyon case, that they are to be applied. We need to look at the facts entirely of the case as to the how things occurred, and then specifically with respect to the prejudice in this. In that Foss unpublished case, they point out the differences between a confession of judgment and a default judgment. In a default judgment, if it's vacated, you go back to court and fight your case. In that unpublished Foss opinion from this court, it says if you vacate a confession of judgment, the creditor is out of luck and they're done. And in the respondent and the appellant's memorandum or reply brief in their conclusion, they essentially ask for dismissal. And the prejudice of that is real to my client.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Cantor, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. I was going to stand up here and make an argument that the history arguments that my learned colleague raised regarding the signatures to the confession of judgment and the withholding of filing it based on the promises were not relevant to any issue before the court. However, later in his argument, he admitted that they could have filed it at any point in time, but they chose not to based on my client's alleged request to work it off. By that simple admission, the cause of action accrued on the day it was signed. By admitting that it could have been filed at any point in time and they chose not to, the cause of action accrued when this confession of judgment was signed. The issue is that my opposing counsel just argued that we are attempting to write a due date into the confession of judgment. Nothing can be further from the truth. It was due the day it was signed. And that's the end of that inquiry. That, in my opinion, establishes that it accrued, the one-year statute of limitations started on that day. Now, as regards to whether or not statutes .22 and .23 are subject to the statute of limitation found in .09, I think by the plain language of the statute, it does. If you look at the plain language of 549.01, no action shall be maintained on any judgment note or other instrument containing any provision authorizing a confession of judgment thereon. Any document that contains a confession of judgment, I would hold to this court that that would also include just a regular confession of judgment. It doesn't need to be included in something else. If you have a confession of judgment, it's done. If it's a document that includes a confession of judgment, you're done. That applies to anything that has a confession of judgment, which is what we have before us here today. The issue of whether it's with action or without action, we actually briefed at the district court level. And an action is a plaintiff and a defendant that results in a judgment. It's that simple. It's been defined by the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court multiple times. We've had a look at this in other cases. We briefed that at the district court level. And what we have here is we have a plaintiff, we have a defendant, and we have a judgment. Whether it's a judgment for money, whether it's a judgment of dismissal, whatever, that's an action. And this says no action shall be maintained, which means it should not have happened. In regards to whether or not dismissing the confession of judgment leaves them without remedy, two things should be noted there. This is a breach of contract case. This is a, potentially a theft by contractor case, as the opposing counsel noted. Assuming the statute of limitations hasn't run on a 6 years, they can file for breach of contract claims. There's nothing that prohibits that. If, for example, on November of 2014, 1 year after the statute of limitations has run, they look at this confession and say, oh, the defendants played us. They let the statute run. I can no longer file this. They can still sue on anything that's within that 6 years. If they wait another 6 years, then that's their choice. And they just admit it. That's their choice. They chose not to file this. So to say they're without recourse because they waited 6 years to file the confession of judgment, not because the confession of judgment is invalid. And the last thing, Your Honor, I did review the decision from March regarding the garnishment. There's two issues there that I think I should bring up. One was that the defendants were arguing at the district court level that it's an excessive judgment because the interest was inappropriately calculated, and the district court said, well, that's not a reason to relieve you of the garnishment because even if the judgment was reduced by $9,000, the garnishment would still be appropriate. But they also went on to, we were arguing the void issue, not voidable at that time. And the judge also came to the conclusion that the statute of limitations defense was not valid because of the without action and the action distinction. I believe that when the issue was fully briefed in May, the judge, just like we recognized that the void versus voidable argument, I believe the judge came to the right decision after having fully briefed that issue. I believe it was
reconsidered, essentially.
Essentially, yes, Your Honor. I believe that at the first go-around, it wasn't fully and adequately briefed. I believe it was at the second time. And I think the second time the judge recognized not only the valid defense of the statute of limitations, which is the one we have focused on extensively here, but there was two other defenses that she also said were valid, which is the interest rate and I forget what the other one was, but there was three, Your Honor, that she said were reasonable defenses on them. Oh, the lack of specificity in the actual confession document. So I believe she got it right the second time around. If there's nothing further, I believe that's my time.
Thank you for your arguments. Thank you to both sides. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days, as required by statute.